I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi. So I think we agreed that we'd start with a nice little reading from Fernanda.
Yeah, sure. I'm very nervous because I feel like I'm going to shatter Shakespeare language. But remember that I wrote it in Spanish, and I'm going to... maybe I should give a little context about this fragment. I choose a fragment at the beginning of the book. It's a scene where a Mexican birthday party is happening, a piñata, and you can see what's... the inner world of Polo, the gardener of this residential complex that's called Paradise, and he's the gardener. He becomes friends with a boy who lives there, and this is just the moment before this sort of friendship begins. That's why he'd been about to jack it all in that Saturday, not just because he'd been made to stay until the end of that brag Mickey's party to clean off the filthy dregs, but because of something that had happened to him earlier that day, hours before the piñata were brought out. When Polo was by the pool, clearing leaves from the water surface with a net, lost in a world of his own, as a whole squad of catering company staff darted back and forth across the garden, setting up tables and chairs and gazebos and even a long, colorful tarp, which, when plugged into a pump, transformed into an imposing bouncy castle, a formidable thing with towers and battlements and flags and chutes and even a drawbridge, a colossal, volatile, ethereal structure that took off each time the breeze blew in from the river, as if it wanted to escape. And Polo was so entertained watching the staff struggle to pin down the castle with straps and pegs that he didn't notice Señora Mariana appear until he smelled her perfume in the air, at which point he turned around to find her standing right in front of him, her body just inches from his, her lips blood red like a vampire's, and her face blushing, missing the trademark sunglasses that instead were hanging from a thin gold chain between her teeth. She was wearing jeans and had something in her hands, a small manila envelope that she held out to Polo without a word, stretching her shameless smile even wider when she saw that the boy couldn't take it because he was holding the long pole skimmer in both hands and eventually slip into the front pocket of his overalls herself with a giggle and, "For your trouble," muttered with false modesty before turning around and sashaying off to oversee the work of her newly acquired maid, a mousy, emaciated-looking girl who in that very moment was clumsily throwing herself into the task of decorating the party chairs with covers and boughs. Polo had the feeling he knew her, that he'd seen her before, at school maybe, but he didn't dare look for long. He didn't want his employer to think he was looking at her. So he went back to the business of cleaning the pool, feigning composure and resisting the urge to put his hand on his overall pocket and touch the envelope to gauge what was inside, at least until lunchtime came around, at which point he could lock himself inside the security hut's tiny toilet, take out the envelope with his name written on one side in glittery purple felt tip pen, and gaze at the two 200 peso banknotes contained within it, both crisp and pressed as if fresh from the cash machine. The overtime, plus tip, which the idiot Urquiza always cheated him out of and which Polo moaned about every time he was made to stay late to clean the mess left over from the parties. A nice cash injection, totally unexpected, and he wouldn't have to tell his mother about it either. He could spend every peso on whatever the hell he liked. Cigarettes, obviously, a couple of bottles of Bacardi, and if it stretched to that, some phone credit so he could text Milton to tell him to get in touch. But even as he made plans in his head, excited by the prospect of spending his sudden windfall, he felt an aching in his chest, and moments later he was doubled over the toilet, regurgitating bile in violent, spluttering spasm, and all for having remembered the look on that bitch's face as she slipped the envelope into his overall pocket and the smile that Polo, like some kind of chump, had been obliged to return against his will, unable to stop the muscle on his face from contracting, even though he despised that slut's air and graces and the barefacedness with which she touched him. Because, frankly, it was 100 times easier to resist the urge to check out her ass when she was jogging around the development in hot pants than to overcome the impulse to return one of Señora Marianne's smiles. She was that magnetic, that enticing, and they'd instantly know what he was talking about if they'd met her in person and experienced firsthand her powers of seduction. Why the hell hadn't he handed the envelope straight back and told her with every ounce of disdain he could muster, "I don't need your handouts, thank you very much"? Why hadn't he thrown it back in her face and let her know what he thought of her? That she was nothing but a whore, a gold digger who thought that going around handing out her husband's spare change somehow made her more respectable? And why the hell hadn't she just handed him the money like a normal person? Was she afraid Polo would make her dirty, that he infected her with his poor higuez? Did the bitch really think she could buy him, that she bought the right to demand whatever she wanted of him, to humiliate him like Urquiza, to make him wash her white SUV or her husband's sport car? Who the fuck did she think she was? The fucking queen bee, judging by her outfit that afternoon, when the party began right on time and she appeared wearing a red dress with blue and green polka dots on it and diamond earrings that glinted whenever she flicked her brown hair from her neck. All afternoon, Polo did what his best to ignore her, but it was as if an invisible force kept putting her in his path. Wherever he turned, there she was, lavishing kisses and hugs on the hordes of little boys and girls running around in swimsuits and on the woman dressed head to toe in tropical prints, as svelte and heavily made up as the hostess herself, their hair straight and inert, as neat, as lifeless as wigs, and their husband just as ridiculous in their pink polos and pastel shirts, ankle grazers and brown loafers, with golf tans and perfectly groomed beards and eyebrows, a click of pompous voices and clinking ice cubes gathering around that smug short-ass Maroño, who spent the entire party taking photos and talking politics and business in the puff-off lingo of professional cocksucker to a fawning audience who knocked back glass after glass of imported whiskey, not even pausing to cop a look at the hostess suite behind, all while their offspring screeched and launched themselves at the juddering bouncy castle walls like raving lunatics and did running cannonballs into the pool, shrieking with suicidal glee yet barely audible over the music blaring from the mountain poolside speakers.
Very impressive.
Fernanda, I listened to a podcast with you, and now I'm going to ask you about lots of things you said, which is very alarming. When you're like, I think you said, but you kind of said firstly about writing Hurricane Season, which is that you wanted to write a non-fiction book initially, like a In Cold Blood kind of thing. And then obviously it turned into fiction. But where did the idea for parodies come from? Or
that's a very interesting question. And I the fun thing about answering questions like this is that it gives me an opportunity to lie better this time. So you know how it is. One write a book, one has an intention in mind, and at the end when the questions come, you have to think quick and just try to give a discourse about it. And with Paradise, what happened was that, the real story behind it is that I with Hurricane Season, I just felt it was a huge success in Mexico and elsewhere too. It is a book that I feel so happy to that I wrote, but at the same time, it took so much from me, like mentally and physically and emotionally, and it was a very strange experience of a book to write. And after when I was thinking about the book, I always got the sense that I did a very strong parallelism between poverty and violence, and that made me awkward. Like, everybody concentrated like on the social aspects of the book, like saying, look, this is what Mexico is, like this is what Mexico is about. And it is true that it is about Mexico and it is about Veracruz, my region, but it's also a metaphor of feeling trapped in a relationship or in a family or somewhere that you cannot escape from, and you want to desperately look for another way, for a way out, and you cannot. And I use poverty, like material poverty, to talk about the spiritual poverty and to talk about moral indigency. Like, what are the extremes where people go when they have been abused?
Yeah.
So at the end, part of the Hurricane Season was a book about suffering is like a circle that repeats itself. You just suffer, and then you make other people suffer, and you make yourself suffer, and it's a continuous vicious cycle. So I thought that maybe the metaphor of poverty had gone too far away, and I just felt awkward that I was saying that poor people are violent or that it could be read like that. Yeah. And I decided that I wanted to talk, because that's another thing that you discover, that you write a book and then you realize that there are some things that you still want to talk about it. And I still wanted to talk about misogynia and machismo and this moral misery. And I still wanted to talk about violence, and I still wanted to talk about Veracruz. So I decided that I needed to write a story in which violence was not tied to social class, or it was tied to several social classes. And this is a little bit how Paradise was born. But this is like the rationalization behind it. But in fact, what made the explosion that made me think about this book was that the story in Hurricane Season happens. The main scenery is a little town called La Matosa. It's fictional. It doesn't exist in Veracruz, but there is a place called La Matosa, and I really love the name because in Spanish it gives an idea of something filled with vegetation, with savage, you know, like green and tropical. And La Matosa is like this place where the grass grows and it becomes even monstrous. And I really like the name, but there is a small town that existed that's called La Matosa. It used to be called La Matosa. It was a small, it's not even a town. I mean, it was a community of 200 people who lived mostly they were fishermen in a lake in Veracruz. And a friend told me, you know the name La Matosa? The real town doesn't exist anymore. The real community doesn't exist anymore because they built a residency complex with a golf course in it. So they bought the lands, they desalojaron, I don't know, they displaced. this place, they evicted all the original population, and they built this super expensive house complex with a golf course and pool and tennis courts. And I mean, and when he told me that, I suddenly paradise was born. And I've been experimenting, watching a lot of these gated communities growing up in Mexico. Sometimes they don't, they are not even like luxurious. They can be like middle class gated communities. But the rise of violence in Mexico, not only narco related violence, you know, like gang violence, but I'm talking about like common crime because of the economic crisis. Regular crime has risen, and people has this fantasy that if they put you know, like walls and barbed wire fence and guards and cameras, they will be protected and violence will be kept outside, like some barbaric influence that they will shut themselves away from that. And I wanted to talk. I wanted to write a story that talk about what happens with violence is not something that you can protect yourself. Because it's inside your community, because it's part of some of your member, the members of this community.
No, I could definitely, and it's such a great setting for a novel. I was thinking like a lot of the kind of reviews do focus on the poverty and on the violence, but your writing of your characters, you never kind of, you're always writing like never above them. You're always like quite close to them, even if they are violent, even if they are. You know, certain their actions are despicable. How do you approach that?
I don't know. It was very organic since the beginning. When I began writing like short stories when I was a teenager, I've always liked to be close to my characters. And my first novel, Falsa Liebre, who's about to be republished in Spanish, it's also very close to the characters, not like this immersive closeness that has Hurricane Season and Paradise, but it is true that I like to depict the world in which the characters live using the same words and using the same expressions that the characters would normally use. And I think that's something that it's an influence from the Latin American boom. There's lots of writers that I grew up reading, like García Márquez, of course, or José Donoso, or Manuel Puig, that really really learn and show me how to use this third voice, but that's inside the characters. Like in Spanish, es el narrador equisciente. Like, it's not omnisciente, it's not omniscient. I don't know if that's even a word in English, I'm sorry. It's not like the Dostoevsky or Tolstoy narrator, like classic one, that is like the voice of God who sees everything from above. Dickens is a little bit like that too. Like the classic novelists, Balzac and Flaubert, will do that. They will look from a cloud and they will look to the characters and know everything of with them. But I prefer to use another type of narrator that goes inside the characters, who can let us feel what the character feels, and for me it's the only way I found interesting to talk about the characters. But of course there are differences. In Paradise, I really wanted to be like really close to Polo, because in fact this novel is about, is like the mental trip of this young person who just did something horrible and is just trying to think what he's going to say to whomever asked him about what just happened. Mm-hmm. So it's like a mental journey. And but at the same time, I really wanted to show other things. I mean, I wanted to emulate extreme act of empathy, like really know how to, it is the life of Polo. How Polo lives, sleeps, eats, have sex, and how he does everything in his life, like from real close. But at the same time, I have to keep a distance. Because what I really want to show in Paradise is that sometimes violence is not only the product of misery, of poverty sometimes, or of this moral indigency that doesn't have anything to do with class, but with abuse and solitude and desperation and this dark side of that everybody we have, but how these how crime and violent acts have something. Sometimes they are senseless. Sometimes violent acts can happen because two stupid boys decided that they wanted to do something, and I needed to create a certain distance, and that's why the language is sometimes close to Polo. Sometimes it uses words that Polo will never use himself to describe his reality. But I needed to create that distance with the language too.
Yeah, no, I definitely, I understand what you mean. But in like, how will I phrase this? In several of the reviews, people are like refer to the two boys kind of as incels, or the idea of like toxic masculinity. Are these like ideas that you would ever think of when you're writing your books, or are they just, does it arise naturally? I think you're very generous like to these characters, in the sense that I still have sympathy for them when I read it, which is an extremely difficult thing to pull off.
It is extremely difficult thing, because they are in fact they're the repulsive characters. But I don't know, but I grew up with people like that sometimes. I mean, we all know a Franco, no? Yeah. I mean, a Polo.
I'm nodding enthusiastically.
Of course.
Yes, I did too.
I mean, I even date them. I mean, I think sometimes I get asked a lot, like, not an interesting question like you did, but sometimes I get asked, for example, like, you are a woman, so how do you do to be inside the mind of male characters who are like, you know, chauvinistic and misogynistic and homophobic and repulsive, and I think that I grew up with these discourses. I mean, I grew up in a certain way with Franco and Polo. I grew up hearing these things, and I at certain point, I will say that I also believe in those things to a certain degree growing up. I mean, I was born in 82, so I grew up in the 90s and the 2000s, and toxic culture was a reality. I mean, I grew up reading Cosmopolitan, giving us advice how to fake orgasm to please men. Like, I mean, that kind of culture was, everything was about guys, everything was about men, and I grew up with that, and I have to deconstruct myself growing up, and I think everything changed for me when I became a stepmother. I had a partner who had a 6-year-old daughter, and I raised her from 6 to 12, and I realized that I grew up at that age, when I was a child, I hated being a woman. I thought it was so unfair. I didn't have any role models, interesting role models. I just think I was a second-class citizen. Everything around my culture told me that being a woman wasn't that interesting, and I hated that, and I didn't want Hannah to feel like that. So I start to challenge these things. And I think the result of that challenge for me is writing. I mean, I'm not much of a critic or much of an essay writer. I don't really, conference speech are not really my thing. When I have an idea, and when I worry about something, when I fear something, when something doesn't let me sleep, I write a novel about it. So of course, all these things were in my head. Even thought I couldn't put a name before, like patriarchy or misogyny, right? And I just wanted to show how sometimes they ask me like why I'm so interested in masculinity, and it's like the opposite of that question when that cliche that the feminine nature is like mysterious and we never know what women want, but we never know what men want. Like, we are all mystery.
Yeah,
you
exactly,
know, like what's behind machismo? I think it was Simone de Beauvoir who said that there's always a mystery behind violence against women. Like, why? Like why we insist so much in controlling women? What is this power that women have that need to be tamed, like, repeatedly across all civilizations? Like, why? And I think my answer or more questions are posed in this novel.
Oh, yeah, definitely questions. Mm-hmm. And you can really see it in his obsession with Marianne, that woman. Like, I feel you write it so well, because he's not even obsessed with her, you know? He's obsessed with this idea of her, and it's sort of like he wants to punish her. I think you write male sexuality so well because it's from an onslaught of images. Even they're confused by it. Even it's horrible to them. I'm thinking of the boys in Hurricane Season as well. So I think you're very generous in how you do it. And it's quite impressive.
Thank you. Sometimes I think that what we think about masculine or feminine is in fact universal. Mm-hmm. Like as women, we've been not allowed for many, many years and decades to speak about sexuality. So sometimes in the culture, there's this idea that female sexuality is more tame and I don't know, like, but women, we watch porn too, and we have fantasies, and desire in women is also really, I mean, there is human desire, mm-hmm. and desire doesn't have any reins. I mean, desire can be really dark. Yeah. It can go to places that we don't want to go, and it will go there. And sometimes we feel like we cannot hold it back. And sometimes desire, sexual desire, but erotic desires are made out of nightmares too. It can scare us, and it can be violent. And I really wanted to talk about it. And for me, I just wanted to place myself into the mind and the body of two growing teenagers who are very different, but mm-hmm. at the same, they are very much alike. Mm-hmm. I mean, Franco is the one who's obsessed with Señora Marianne, who has this wider range of fantasies inspired by porn, especially of what he wants to do with Señora Marianne, one he can... grab her but at the same time there's also a vulnerable core inside him, and you can tell that what's like troven inside this desire is something more than sex. Mm-hmm. It has to do with feelings, and it has to do with this terrible loneliness of this guy who grows up raised by his grandfather. Parents who don't give a damn about mm-hmm. him at all. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, you have Polo, who apparently he's not even that interested in sex, apparently, mm-hmm. and who despises women equally. But you can see that in his despise, there's always a component of fear. It is not that he hates women, it's that he fears women. Mm-hmm. And there's this symbol that I use, this metaphor of the bloody contest. I don't even know the names of the characters in English. The bloody contest that is based on a local legend in Veracruz, but also it's mixed with Elizabeth Báthory, for example. And you have the legend of these powerful women in the colony that used to sexually abuse her slaves and then murder them. Mm-hmm. So for Polo is this figure in which he places all his anxieties against women. Mm-hmm. Like all the impotence he feels in regard to his mother, who is very dominant, in regard to his cousin, who is very dominant and dominates him in ways that he cannot even understand. And Señora Marianne, who's also a dominant female figure in his life. So I realize now that I always write, at least in Paradise and in Hurricane Season, I always write about scapegoats, how murder and crime and violence ends up being something very difficult, different of the intention of what's being done. Mm-hmm. So I think for me it's interesting to try to explore this dark side, this hidden side and more emotional side of crime, of violence.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And why you want the things you do and why you desire the things you do. I've asked lots of questions about men. I'm going to ask a question about women. You write very, like, women don't get off lightly in your book either. They're also aggressors, you know, maybe more emotionally and things, but I think you write that very well, and they often take it out on their children. And can you talk a little bit about...
I I think, I mean, this is my way of thinking about things, writing stories. So I've been thinking a lot lately, from years on, about what role do we women have in this reproduction of violence? And of course, there's also another stereotype, that is, women are always the victims.
Yeah.
And of course, if we have to put a face on violence in general, it has a male face, statistically and whatever you want to put it. It is true that it's more common for women to be victims and to men to be aggressors. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, violence and machismo and this misogyny also, talking about my own experience, like growing up and really believing these things and really growing up to be competitive against other women or despising other women or considering women under the rule of men, because that's how I grew up and that's how I was raised, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out why is that, like, mm-hmm. like why is so special in masculinity.
Yeah.
And also, I think that growing up in a dysfunctional family where men and women were equally aggressive to each other, I mean, my mom and my dad are like awesome people, like I really love them, but they were not meant to be together, like really, they had the most difficult relationship. They were like dogs and cats, like different species, and they decided to stick together for the sake of their children, but still there was a lot of violence going on all the time. And I'm not talking, there was sometimes physical violence, but mostly there was psychological violence, like verbal abuse. Mm-hmm. And you grow up like that, and I think it makes you, for me, that happened, that I see violence everywhere. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have to talk about Mexican reality and femicide and all the impunity and crime that's going on in Mexico. But I sometimes do want to desperately cry and say, that happens too here. Like, mm-hmm. there's violence everywhere. Like, there's violence against women everywhere. And there's violence against, I mean, we have the war in Ukraine right mm-hmm. now, and it's horrible and yeah. it's terrible and it's everywhere. And it's not something that in Mexico we have it in our genes or in our genetic makeup. I don't know. Like, I discover it everywhere, because I think I was familiarized when I was a child, and I can see it. And for me, it was very important to talk about how perfect victims don't exist.
Yeah.
And perfect aggressors, mm-hmm. that we are all humans. And what I like to do is, I think I have the inspiration of Truman Capote, mm-hmm. Also for Hurricane Season, because mm-hmm. at first I wanted Hurricane Season to be a nonfiction novel. But then I think what Truman Capote does in Cold Blood, it's amazing, because he is brilliant. He manages to show us a character, a deeply disturbed character, who had suffered in life so much and who did horrible things, but we never lose the human side, but also the horrible things that they do. We get to see the whole person. And for me, that's my direction. I want to do that. I want to be able to present the reader with human and disgusting characters, as we are sometimes. We can all be like that.
Yeah, of course.
And
yeah.
That's part of my program, yeah. I think. I've been doing that. And of course, sometimes Paradise is a little bit different, because it has humor in it. I think it's a, it's, well, dark, it's, yeah, dark, it's very dark funny. Humor. But,
yeah. It's very funny.
It's I like humor that makes you like laugh and then feel awkward. Yeah. About and you guys have a really a tradition here, of course, of that kind of humor.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I am going to ask you about, so when Adam Myers-Jones reviewed Hurricane Season in the London Review of Books, and he said, "The institutes of church and state continue to fulfill their function, even if that function is almost purely oppressive. And there's just enough religious education to convince young people that they might be damned." I have a special interest in this because I'm Irish. And I think we a similar kind of situation. We had a lot of control from the church and a lot of oppressive religion. And then when that left, there was just nothing really to kind of fill that void. And I was raised in a Catholic family, but I'm almost no one goes to church, you know, like it's not really there anymore, but it's still in me. And it certainly still comes out in my work. Do you find something similar in religion?
I guess I do. In fact, in Ireland, you have that problem too with abortion laws, that it's terrible.
We fixed that.
Okay, well,
just in time.
Well, in Mexico we haven't been able, but in Mexico we are a federal republic, so it's to each state to approve, and some states had managed to approve it, but it's still not a right that's granted.
Very recently in Ireland.
It's very complicated, and a lot of has to do with Catholic traditions and Catholic like growing up being a Catholic. Yeah. But in Mexico, I think religion still has a stronger grasp in people. Mm-hmm. I think it's very peculiar because it's not... I know there's people who never go to church, but they will go each year to sing happy birthday to Virgin Mary, to Virgin Guadalupe, on December 12th and in Mexico. So, and you have this... you have people who are, I don't know, like delinquents who work on crime, and they will go and each month ask for forgiveness to the saints, and it's more like in Italy, I think, too, that you have even saints that are specialized in tending to the spiritual needs of criminals in Mexico, like Malverde or La Santísima Muerte. Have you seen images of this skeleton with a cloak, and I mean it's impressive, like a medieval image, and it's worship in Mexico, and it's really something that really stems out of popular culture. You know, like it is not the Pope or the Cardinal say, and you have to do this. It's like it stems from the people. And it is true that in Mexico we have a very traditionalistic still views in lots of things, like in gender and sexuality. It's difficult. I can tell you, it's changing, slowly changing, but I think sometimes you feel like advances, like we can now have abortion in some parts of Mexico, or you can legally marry if you with a partner of the same sex, but it feels like in any time that can, you know, like taken back, taken away. It can be taken away, and it's. I think my books reflect that sort of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like I don't think the church appears in paradise that much.
Yeah,
it's more in hurricane season. And it is more in the repressive education that the character Brando has received from his mother. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to show in that character is how, for me, there is no worse nightmare than to live a life having to deny what are your most deep desires. And Brando has that. He has to deny what he feels about other men. Mm-hmm. He really desires other men, and he has to shut that desire. He has to contain desire, like suppress it, and he turns to violence in his efforts to deny himself, and he tries to explain what he feels by calling it like this is the influence of the devil. He doesn't really believe that, but he's been like programmed to believe that. And I just wanted to, for me, it's just one of these elements. Mm-hmm. And it is true that in Veracruz, religion is very contradictory, because for some things it is not very present, but for others it is mm-hmm. has still like morally it has still a strong grip in society.
And I think if you kind of hear these things from a young age, or you read about like as I would have. It's in you. So like you've learned it already. So of when course. You sit down to write, it's all going to come out, all the shame and the whatever
I always,
else.
I mean,
none of the good stuff.
Of course. I think I always write about, up until now, I've been concentrated in writing about teenage characters. Mm-hmm. Because for me, the adolescence is such a special stage where you first become, for the first time, you feel like a person. Mm-hmm. But still, you cannot go back to childhood, but it's like you're in front of a cliff. And you see nothing in front of you. It's so scary to mm-hmm. be an adolescent, and it's such an interesting moment, like dramatically, to start experiencing this existential angst. It's the first time for me. It was for example the first time when I decided that I didn't believe in God, and it was devastating for me. Yeah. And I think writing has a lot to do with that moment. I think I first started writing when I first said, "No, I don't believe in this. This cannot be true." Like. I decided that I won't believe, and it was a very awkward stage because we've been going to I come from a very Catholic family. We will go every Sunday to mass, mm-hmm. and my dad is not going to mass. My dad will insist that we go and sit in the front pew it's called, like in the front bench, because he know the priest from, like, I think the priest baptized him. I mean, it's like a long tradition, and I have an uncle who's a priest. Yeah. And when I decided that I wouldn't believe, I decided that I couldn't fake it. So when everybody kneeled, I stayed standing up in the front pew. And my parents at first forced me to go to church when I didn't want to. And then they were so embarrassed that I did that they say, okay, you can stay home. And
that's so smart.
And I will stay home. And for me, it was like for the first time being alive, like mm-hmm. being a person, like having her time. I think I began writing because I decided to not go to church anymore.
I just lied and said I went, and
my brother would say that, like, why don't you just fake it and make my parents happy? And I said, no, I cannot fake it. Yeah. I couldn't do it.
I feel like also sometimes when I'm writing, it's sort of like I said, I feel like I've been indoctrinated by some of this stuff, but like it's giving yourself over to like a sort of kind of higher power as well, writing, you know, it's a sort of Catholic idea that you would like give yourself up to something.
Sometimes I think that the most spiritual thing that I do is writing, because it connects you with something, with things that you don't even know, you haven't been able to name yet. It's also like, I think it was Jung that said, the psychoanalyst, he said that we're like islands, or we feel like we're islands, but there is something that connects us all. And when we write, mm-hmm. we connect ourselves to that telluric thing hidden underneath that we sometimes cannot name, but we try to do when we write. And when you write, sometimes you connect in certain ways with readers, because you connect. Beside words and ideas, you connect from that deep current, and art is like that. I think art is the most spiritual thing that I don't know.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. I agree. Definitely the most spiritual thing I do. I just want to ask you about how your books are written, because they're written in this very kind of present kind of. Yeah, moments of extremity is what I kind of. Mm. I think you like moments of intensity. And I was listening to an interview with you. Where you're talking about, well, and I feel it too, like for this generation, there's a lot of hopelessness, kind of, mm-hmm. you can't perceive a future. Is that why you feel, does your form of your books kind of reflect that? They're almost written at speed, like a person like trying to get to say something before, you know, they're stopped or...
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm a very intense person, so I think that reflects in my writing. And I just found this way of writing that before Hurricane Season, it was different. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was interested in going deep with the emotion of the characters. I was interested in showing things, all good and bad inside the characters, but this way of writing, like so vertiginous and so, like, I don't even know the words in English, but like dense mm-hmm. and propelling, like mm-hmm. like I just found it with Hurricane Season, and I think that I thought that back then, as I like to explain it, I think that the subject matter and the things that I was talking about or willing to talk about were so tough and so difficult and emotionally draining that I knew that I needed a very express way of writing, like a very express way of reading even, so the reader could hang onto that, like, I don't know, like the Ferris wheel, like, you know, like something that holds you into your seat. And I also think it's a reaction to, I mean, I grew up not with social media, but from my early 20s, I would use social media, and I've been also very experiencing distractions. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very difficult for me to concentrate. I had to abandon social network, social media, because I will be reading, and 15 minutes after, I will read something that excites me, and I will instantly want to tweet it. Or I think about tweets. Yeah. Sometimes I will say, oh, I don't have... It's been 3 years, 2 years that I don't have Twitter, and still I think about tweets sometimes. Like, man, I wish I could... Yeah, like, oh, I have to... And I think this is a way to... You have to write like this in order to grab the attention of readers that become each time more scarce. Like mm-hmm. attention yeah. is such a treasure right now. And I don't know. I sometimes think I explain it that way because it makes sense for me. Like I love books that just grab me by the mm-hmm. neck and just, you know, like pull me in. I love that experience. And I write mostly novels because I like that feeling of a journey that a novel gives you. Right, like. Like a novel is not paradise because it's very short, but Hurricane Season. The novels, think about the novels you like, and it's like going in a trip.
Yeah.
It's like going into a journey. Mm-hmm. And you spend several nights or several days with those characters, and you get to know them. It's like a trip. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you get that impression. But with Paradise, I wanted something different. With Paradise, I wanted it to be like a dream, yeah. like a movie. Mm-hmm. You know, like something that you just... immerse yourself into it, mm-hmm. and then you go out like grasping for breath. That's mm-hmm. what I really wanted with this novel.
Yeah, yeah. I could. It's very movie-ish. that is another thing I want to ask you. So in your novels, I think reality feels very real, like ultra real, and then fantasy also feels very real. You know, their fantasies also, uh-huh. and that's why I think when they don't escape their circumstances, it's even more kind of heartbreaking. Your epigraph in this mm-hmm. is from David Lynch. Are you a fan of his work?
I am David Lynch's granddaughter.
She said that like downstairs, and like, I believed her. I was like, what?
No, I named myself to be it. But no, I just David Lynch is such an inspiring artist for me. I think I watched Blue Velvet when I was like 15, and I in Mexico, but back then in Mexico, in Veracruz especially, it was very hard to find this sort of indie non-commercial films in the at the end of the 90s. So I remember I went to do you know the concept of tianguis? It's like a market, but it's like very informal one. And you go to the tianguis, and there's a el tianguis del chopo. It's a market, but it's where you went to buy your goth outfit or your skateboards, like really hypey and cool in the 90s. And there will be this guy who sell piracy VHS tapes. But it was a thing back then because it was that or nothing. So. I don't know, once I went there when I was like 15 and I bought, a film by David Cronenberg, yeah. a film by David Lynch, and it was another one, let me remember. I mean, there was things that I've been reading in magazines and couldn't find it anywhere. And I bought Blue Velvet in a, you know, like VHS mm-hmm. tape with a, somebody felt it, read it, and I was stunned, like really mesmerized by this narrative the crudity of it all, but at the same time, the surreal quality. I mean, I was just, mm-hmm. I fell in love with David Lynch's work, and I follow him since from then on, and I think I still I think for our generation who grew up watching TV, film, and it's part of our narrative, isn't it? It's like it's the books that we've read, but it's also the films that we've watched, and it's also the music we've heard, and all the time it's okay. And all the time we are. For me, it showed me also a way to narrate.
Yeah,
and I think this. I'm trying to remember the epigraph. Mm-hmm. This song is not in the films. Mm-hmm. It's in a really strange spectacle that David Lynch staged. That's called the Industrial Symphony.
Okay, yeah.
It was like a spectacle, like a live spectacle with a projection of things and Nicolas Cage doing weird things on stage, and it was in the Wild at Heart time. Yeah. And Julie Cruz is also a singer. If you YouTube it, if you search it on YouTube, it's an amazing piece of song. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that the lyrics of that song was just about what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I fell for you like a bomb, and now my heart is in flames. And I really wanted to talk about how we talk about love and passion sometimes in a very romantic way. But I think it was psychoanalyst Andre Green, French psychoanalyst Andre Green, who said that, in fact, passion is madness.
Yeah.
When you are in love, you are crazy. You mm-hmm. you lost your mind. You lose your mind. And I wanted to talk about what happened when a teenager thinks he loves somebody and lost his mind about this person.
Yeah, and it goes kind of so far as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I haven't get so far to do transcendental meditation. Like Devin Lynch always trying to convince people to do it, because I don't have patience to do transcendental meditation. But I have found in his films some narrative forms that I think that are very interesting and that talk about humankind in a very powerful way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. I think we should... Questions, yes. I went 25 microphone. Minutes over an event I did recently.
Sorry,
so.
I talked too much. You know.
There will also be questions from a cyber audience, although I haven't had any yet, so you lot get a shoe in. Who's first?
Thank you for that. I was wondering, when you talk about Polo, he has this rage and this anger. When you were talking about the writing experience briefly about it, and sort of the intensity and your character into that, what are you thinking and what are you feeling when you are sitting down to channel him?
I have to confess that with Polo wasn't so immersive as it was with Brando, for example, in Hurricane Season. They are very much alike. They are angry young men. And coming here, I always try to think like local influences into my writing, because you never know who's going to ask you, who's your like British writer, And I just saw that there was this new edition of Brighton Rock, Graham Greene Brighton Rock in Spanish, and I just remembered that, of course, that Brando and Polo are a little bit like Pinky in Brighton Rock, and I really love that book and Graham Greene's first novel, I think, and Polo wasn't that close to me. In fact, Brando, I lived inside Brando, and that was very much devastating. And especially because when I was writing Hurricane Season, before Brando, it was always Norma. So being Norma, being this pregnant 13-year-old who, you know, is lost in the middle of all these strangers trying to understand what just happened to her and what she's going to do with her life, is just, it was awful enough. And then I remember myself writing the draft of Hurricane Season, working on the revising, and I will always get depressed after finishing with Norma, but depressed is just not the word. I mean, I remember myself in the couch, like, you know, hecha ovillo. I don't know how to say that in English, like, you know, like all in a fetal position and crying my eyes out, just feeling horrible and thinking, and now I have to do Brando after this, and I will cry even harder. And then I will just put myself into it, and I mean, it's something that I just have to do, because they are all part of me, and you pull out of yourself all this dark stuff. Of course, you magnify it. Of course, I'm not a guy. I never raped anyone or been raped, for example, no? But I have an imagination, a very tricky one, and I lend them all the feelings that I could manage. And that's why I ended up, when I wrote Hurricane Season afterwards, I had to go to therapy, because it really confronted me with a lot of feelings that I wasn't ready to express, like, clearly and see it. And then with Paradise, I think I learned the lesson, or it was just different. In Hurricane Season, I wanted to say, look, there's misery in the world that reproducts itself all the time. And in Paradise, I just wanted to say, look, there's violence, but sometimes it's just done by horrible people with no meaning at all. And with Polo, I needed to be able to mock him, to mock his cowardice and his hypocrisy. And he thinks he's this big shot guy, you know, but in fact, he's a scary little boy. And I didn't went too down into him, because I needed to feel this distance. But I do went inside enough to make him a character, maybe not a compelling one, but at least a real one and a dense one. So it was pretty much like that with Paradise and Polo. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Your work is looking at the darker side of Mexican life, and uncovering maybe some uncomfortable truths and highlighting people on maybe the fringes of society. So I'm just curious as to how it's seen in Mexico itself, how people have reacted to it. I'm curious about that.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Liz. I think in Mexico, the book is doing great. I mean, Hurricane Season, it just started like, I never expected anything from that book. It was my second novel. So in your second novel, you're always trying to, like, I don't know, at least in my case, the first one is just you learn how to do a novel. And then in the second one, you want to put, in Mexico we say, all the meat in the barbecue grill. You want to put it all, like everything. And I wanted to do this tour de force, so I just condensed everything that I learned from language, from the boom writers, but also other writers that I admired, and I just really want to tell this story that was very local, but at the same time, I think it could be universal. Like, to talk about the dark side of the human soul, it's always universal. We all have a dark side, and it was amazing, because I thought that maybe one critic will read it and do. I knew that it was a technical feat and that it was a dark, obscure novel, but with many virtues. And I thought that maybe one or two critics will write something about it, and it will be lost in the times, and nobody will. And I will start writing another book, and that will be it. And it began to be read by people, and now in Mexico it's being read normally by people who don't even are in literary circles. Like, I'm not a commercial writer in the sense like a bestseller who sells millions, but I'm something in between, and it's very awkward for my publishing house in Mexico because they don't really know. It's something in the middle, and it's been very surprising for everybody. And the reactions in Mexico is finally somebody's talking about what's truly happening in Mexico and with a language that everybody can understand. And well, in Veracruz, some people will say, ah, she's just talking about gossip, like local gossip, like there's no merit about it. And I will say, okay, it's their opinion. It can be like that. And other people will concentrate because I have a journalistic background. I studied journalism. I did journalism, but I was a freelancer. I never worked for a newspaper or anything. But I. There are some people who like to see only the social side of hurricane season, and not see at all the artifice behind it, and because it's in Spanish, it's really Southeast Mexican lingo. It's very. I just feel so grateful to have a translator like Sophie, who managed to create a language, because I that's what I did. I created a language that is very similar to how people talk in the southeast of Mexico, and I think she managed to do that sort of things. I always felt surprised because when I was thinking about when they told me they weren't going to translate it in English, I always thought they will be filled with motherfuckers, for example, because hijo de la chingada translates very well, but Sophie is British, so she filled it with cunts, and I mean it's so nice, and she had to create also a language that is not exactly, you know, like the language here, but it's something in the middle. You always do that when you write. So I don't know. I think in Mexico many people think I'm a genius, or many people think that I did nothing special, just put a recorder and just transcribe what people talk in Mexico and copy something that I read in the newspaper. So you will find anything like that.
Can we take one from cyberspace?
Okay.
Christabel asks, you mentioned García Márquez. To what extent do you identify with the magic realism tradition in Latin American literature? I ask this because I get the impression that even more so in Paradise, the magic realism aspect is completely overpowered by violence and brutality.
That's what's scary, right? Like in Mexico, sometimes when I have a book of nonfiction that's called "This Is Not Miami," I wrote stories about Veracruz, the stories that I've heard, the stories that I heard growing up, and then I research, like journalistically research, and to find the story behind it. And sometimes, I swear to you that I sometimes had to tone down reality so it can be real life, like it can be verosimil, it can be like believable. And the thing in Mexico, it is like that. Reality is, if I mean, when we talk about, there are right now associations of mothers and sisters and aunts and grandmothers who go and travel to deserted lands and they dig with their own hands in looking for mass graves, and they discover the bones of their own children with their own hands. You will think it's like the craziest idea, but that happens in Mexico every day. And the things that we've seen in the last 15 years because of the war against drugs, it's just crazy. It's like Dante's Inferno, and it's very hard to write fiction having those kind of things happening all around us all the time. And I do appreciate magical realism. Now it's always difficult to talk about because it is true that it is. Es una etiqueta. It is a sort of a label that's been. It was imposed not by Latin American writers, but by a Spanish one. So it was the way that we tried to understood what the way to see of García Márquez, the way they tried to create metaphors about social reality, poetic metaphors about this. for example, the dictatorship, no? And he created this character of a dictator that lived 120 years, and it was a metaphor of course of Fidel. And I mean, I just don't use that label, magical realism. But I understand where it comes, and I grew up reading, of course, magical realism, and I just don't think I need it. I mean, I've been concentrated in writing from realism, but it is true that I think Paradise is sort of a turning point, because most of the things that happens here in this novel is mental stuff. It's fantasies. Yeah. And I want to start writing in a way that gives more space to fantasy life, to this sort of believing, to things that are not precisely real.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Thank you. I just had one question about the title, Paradise. And, you know, obviously there's a deep and pretty unsettling irony to it, in the sense of what the book talks about. But I guess I wondered whether there's a sense in which you're also gesturing towards the biblical paradise and the ideas of temptation and the fall from grace and all of these themes. And at the same time, because of the way you spell it, whether you're gesturing towards Mexico's relationship to the US, which is such a complex and interesting relationship as well, and whether you could say anything about that.
Of course. In fact, To really show the real pronunciation of paradise, it would have to be different. But I with this title, I try to mock a little bit how we Mexicans pronounce paradise, like with the open A. Yes, of course, we have this scene where Paul is signing his contract and he says, like, I'm going to work in Paradise. That is the way that in Mexico we will pronounce that word, and the administrator says it's paradise. Say it well, please repeat it. No, okay. And for me, it's such an humiliating act, right? Like, and also, it's I wanted to reflect this reality in which I mean, Mexico. It's a country that's been colonized not only by Spaniards in the colony, but also by, of course, American culture, North American culture. And for everything to be cool or expensive or luxurious, it has to be in English. I don't know if it works here, but for example, in German, it has to be in French. Mm. You know, like, or in Finland, it has to be in Swedish. Mm. You know, like shampoo is made in Sweden. Oh, it's made in Sweden, right? Like, I don't know. I don't know the particularities here, but we all have like this sort of relationship, and in Mexico it's like that. We for something to be really cool and exclusive and expensive, has to have a name in English. Mm-hmm. And I just really wanted to mock that and to mock the idea that this perfect space, beautiful, heaven, paradise. In fact, it's invaded from within with evilness, and from the beginning I knew, because there is this when I was a child, I spent much time in Tabasco. It's another state in Veracruz in the southeast, and Villahermosa is the capital, and it's not in the beach. You have to travel 2 hours to go to see the sea, and there's this tiny city called Paraíso. And it's for employees of the oil petrol companies, so it imitates like these American United States villas and Californian type of houses, and some of them were like in ruins. It was a very strange place, and I just thought about it when I thought about this gated community. So I just wanted to name it something like Paraíso. And I thought paradise, but I thought about Paraíso Lezama Lima's the Cuban writer Paraíso too. So I sometimes find out that it was the wrong spelling and mispronunciation of this world, and then you work after I work to make the symbols more clearly. Now this sort of Garden of Eden that gets constantly invaded by wild nature and or for example the name of the character Milton. At first, it wasn't that name. It was something similar. And I was looking for, because it's very common in Veracruz that people get names like American, not American, but Anglo-Saxon names. And I was thinking about, and I know people who are called Milton in Mexico, for example, or Herbert, or like names like that. Yeah, really. And when I give him that name, something like click, like, but this is like, after writing the first draft, when you want to put it all close, knit it closer, like knit it more closer.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Fernando will be very happy to sign copies of the book.
Of course.
If you rush forwards and have a chat there as well. And round of applause, I think.
Sure. Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.